Initially, of course, feelings of grief and anxiety are a natural human response to a loss. But if you allow these feelings of loss and worry to persist, there's a danger. If these feelings are left unchecked, they can lead to a kind of self-absorption, a situation where the focus becomes your own self. And when that happens, you become overwhelmed by the sense of loss, and you get a feeling that it's only you who is going through this. Depression sets in. But in reality, there are others who will be going through the same kind of experience. So if you find yourself worrying too much, it may help to think of the other people who have similar or even worse tragedies. Once you realize that, then you no longer feel isolated, as if you have been picked out. That can offer you some kind of condolence.
The wish to be free of suffering is the legitimate goal of every human being. It is the corollary of our wish to be happy. Thus, it is entirely appropriate that we seek out the causes of our unhappiness and do whatever we can to alleviate our problems, searching for solutions on all levels, global, societal, family, and individual. But as long as we view suffering as an unnatural state, an abnormal condition that we fear, avoid, and reject, we will never uproot the causes of suffering or begin to live a happier life.
Chapter 9, Self-Created Suffering and Change.
What type of future will come about to a large extent lies within your own hands in the present. It will be determined by the kind of initiatives that we take now.
We have discussed the importance of accepting suffering as a natural fact of human existence and facing our problems directly and authentically. While some kinds of suffering are inevitable, others are self-created. With growing technology, the general level of physical comfort has improved for many in Western society. This has caused a critical shift in perception. As suffering becomes less visible, it is no longer seen as part of the fundamental nature of human beings, but rather as an anomaly, a sign that something has gone terribly wrong, a sign of the failure of some system, an infringement on our guaranteed right to happiness. This kind of thinking poses hidden dangers. If we think of suffering as something unnatural, something that we shouldn't be experiencing, then it's not much of a leap to begin to look for someone to blame for our suffering. If I'm unhappy, then I must be the victim of someone or something, an idea that is all too common in the West. The victimizer may be the government, the educational system, abusive partners, a dysfunctional family, the other gender, or our uncaring mate. Or we may turn blame inward. There's something wrong with me. I'm the victim of disease, of defective genes, perhaps. By continuing to focus on assigning blame and maintaining a victim stance, we perpetuate our suffering and our related feelings of anger, frustration, and resentment. This is one way that we can create our own suffering, but we add to our own suffering in other ways also. All too often, for example, we perpetuate pain, keep it alive, by replaying our hurts over and over in our minds, elaborating and magnifying our injustices in the process.
We can see that there are many ways in which we actively contribute to our own experiences of mental unrest and suffering. Although in general, mental and emotional afflictions themselves can come naturally, often it is our own reinforcement of those negative emotions that make them so much worse. For instance, when we have anger or hatred towards a person, and we keep on thinking about it over and over, then it feeds the hatred. It makes it very powerful and intense. We also often add to our pain and suffering by being very overly sensitive, overreacting to minor things, and sometimes taking things too personally. So I think that to a large extent, whether or not you suffer depends on how you respond to a given situation. For example, let's say that you find out that someone is speaking badly of you behind your back. If you react to this knowledge that someone is speaking badly of you, this negativity, with a feeling of hurt or anger, then you yourself destroy your own peace of mind. your pain is your own personal creation. On the other hand, if you can refrain from reacting in a negative way, let the slander pass by you as if it were silent wind passing behind your ears, you would protect yourself from that feeling of hurt and feeling of agony. So, although you may not always be able to avoid difficult situations, you can modify the extent to which you suffer by how you choose to respond to the situation.
Therapists sometimes call the process described by the Dalai Lama personalizing our pain, the tendency to narrow our psychological field of vision by interpreting or misinterpreting everything that occurs in terms of its impact on us. When this kind of thinking becomes a pervasive pattern and extends to include every comment made by our family or friends, or even events in society at large, it can become a significant source of our misery. As Jacques Lusseron, a survivor of the Buchenwald concentration camp, wrote in later recounting his experiences in the camps, "Unhappiness, I saw then, comes to each of us because we think ourselves at the center of the universe, because we have the miserable conviction that we alone suffer to the point of unbearable intensity. As we've discussed, problems invariably arise in our daily life, but problems do not automatically cause suffering. If we directly address a problem and focus our energies on finding a solution, for instance, the problem can be transformed into a challenge. If we throw into the mix, however, a feeling that our problem is unfair, we add an additional ingredient that can become a powerful fuel in creating mental and emotional suffering." The Dalai Lama spoke about how to deal with the problem of unfairness.
There may be a variety of ways that one might deal with the feeling that one's suffering is unfair. We've already spoken of the importance of accepting suffering as a natural fact of existence. Tibetans, or those of a Buddhist background, may be able to better accept the reality of difficult situations by attributing it to karma, to negative actions committed in either this or a previous life. For those in the West who believe in the idea of a creator, of God, they may accept difficult situations easier by viewing them as part of God's creation or plan. They may be helped by the faith that even though the situation appears very negative, God is all-powerful and very merciful, and there may be some meaning behind the situation that they may be unaware of. For those with no religious beliefs, perhaps a practical scientific approach could help. A kind of examination of the situation without much emotional involvement. A rational objective analysis of difficult or problematic situations can be quite important, because with this approach, you'll often discover that behind the scenes, there may be other factors at play. For instance, if you feel that you're being treated unfairly by your boss at work, perhaps he may be annoyed by something else, an argument with his wife that morning or something, and his behavior may have nothing to do with you personally, may not be specifically directed at you. Of course, one must still face whatever the situation may be, but at least with this approach, one may not have the additional anxiety that would come along with it. Often, our normal tendency is to try to blame our problems on others, on external factors. Furthermore, we tend to look for one single cause and then try to exonerate ourselves from the responsibility. It seems that whenever there are intense emotions involved, there tends to be a disparity between how things appear and how they really are. This practice involves looking at things in a holistic way, realizing that there are many events contributing to a situation. So, for instance, in general, if we carefully examine any situation in a very unbiased and honest way, we may realize that to a large extent, we are also responsible for the unfolding of events.
Through practices such as these, such as objectively analyzing our own contribution to problems, which we initially blame completely on others, one can begin to reduce the feeling of unfairness that is one of the most common sources of self-created suffering. In investigating the ways in which we contribute to our own experience of suffering, we conclude with one of the primary causes, resistance to change. In discussing this important topic, the Dalai Lama described the ever-changing nature of life.
It's extremely important to investigate the causes or origins of suffering, how it arises. One must begin that process by appreciating the impermanent, transient nature of our existence. All things, events, and phenomena are dynamic, changing every moment. Nothing remains static. Meditation on one's blood circulation could serve to reinforce this idea. The blood is constantly flowing, moving. It never stands still. This momentarily changing nature phenomena is like a built-in mechanism. And since it is the nature of all phenomena to change every moment, this indicates to us that all things lack the ability to endure, lack the ability to remain the same. And since all things are subject to change, nothing exists in a permanent condition, nothing is able to remain the same under its own independent power. Thus, all things are under the power or influence of other factors. So, at any given moment, no matter how pleasant or pleasurable your experience may be, it will not last. This becomes the basis of a category of suffering known in Buddhism as the suffering of change.
The concept of impermanence plays a central role in Buddhist thought. As the Dalai Lama has noted, it serves to remind us that life is tenuous and our time must be used to one's best advantage. On a deeper level, the contemplation of the more subtle aspects of impermanence, the impermanent nature of all phenomena, begins the Buddhist practitioner's quest to understand the true nature of reality, and through this understanding, dispel the ignorance that is the ultimate source of our suffering. But whether one looks at life from a Buddhist perspective or a Western perspective, the fact remains that life is change. And to the degree that we refuse to accept this fact and resist the natural changes of life, trying desperately to hold on to the past, for example, we will continue to perpetuate our own suffering.
Chapter 10, Shifting Perspective.
The ability to look at events from different perspectives can be very helpful. Then practicing this, one can use certain experiences, certain tragedies, to develop a calmness of mind.
The ability to shift perspective can be one of the most powerful and effective tools we have to help us cope with life's daily problems, both large and small.
One must realize that every phenomena, every event, has different aspects. Everything is of a relative nature. For example, in my own case, I lost my country. It is very tragic, and there are even worse things. There's a lot of destruction happening in our country. That's a very negative thing. But if I look at the same event from another angle, I realize that as a refugee, I have another perspective. As a refugee, there is no need for formalities, ceremony, protocol. If everything were status quo, if things were okay, then on a lot of occasions, you merely go through the motions, you pretend. But when you are passing through desperate situations, there's no time to pretend. So from that angle, this tragic experience has been very useful to me. Also, being a refugee creates a lot of new opportunities for meeting with many people. People from different religious traditions, from different walks of life, those who I may not have met had I remained in my country. So, in that sense, it's been very, very useful. It seems that often when problems arise, our outlook becomes narrow. all of our attention may be focused on worrying about the problems, and we may have a sense that we're the only one that is going through such difficulties. This can lead to a kind of self-absorption that can make the problem seem very intense. When this happens, I think that seeing this from a wider perspective can definitely help realizing, for instance, that there are many other people who have gone through similar experiences and even worse experiences. This practice of shifting perspective can even be helpful in certain illnesses or pain. If you only look at that one event, then it appears bigger and bigger. If you focus too closely, too intensely on a problem when it occurs, it appears uncontrollable. But if you compare that event with some other greater event, look at the same problem from a distance, then it appears smaller and less overwhelming.
The ability to shift perspective, the capacity to view one's problems from different angles, is nurtured by a certain supple quality of mind. The ultimate benefit of a supple and flexible mind is that it allows us to embrace all of life, to be fully alive and human. Following a long day of public talks in Tucson one afternoon, the Dalai Lama slowly walked back to his hotel suite. As he walked, a bank of magenta rain clouds spanned the sky, absorbing the late afternoon light and sending the Catalina Mountains into deep relief. The entire landscape, a vast palette of purple hues. The effect was spectacular. The warm air was laden with the fragrance of desert plants, of sage, a moist, restless breeze holding the promise of an unbridled storm. The Dalai Lama stopped. For several moments, he quietly surveyed the horizon, taking in the entire panorama, finally commenting on the beauty of the setting. He walked on, but after a few steps, he paused again, bending down to examine a tiny lavender bud on a small plant. He touched it gently, noting its delicate form, and wondered aloud about the name of the plant. I was struck by the facility of his mind. His awareness seemed to move so easily from taking in the complete landscape to focusing on a single bud, a simultaneous appreciation of the totality of the environment as well as the smallest detail, a capacity to encompass all facets and the full spectrum of life. Every one of us can develop this same suppleness of mind. It comes about, at least in part, directly through our efforts to stretch our perspective and deliberately try on new viewpoints. This can result in a simultaneous awareness of the big picture as well as our individual circumstances, putting our experiences in proper proportion. This dual outlook, a concurrent view of the big world and our own little world, can act as an internal navigational system, guiding us towards ultimate fulfillment of both our own goals and larger societal goals.
When you speak of adopting a wider perspective, this includes working cooperatively with other people. When you have crises, which are global by nature, for instance, such as the environment or problems of modern economic structure, this calls for a coordinated and concerted effort among many people with a sense of responsibility and commitment. This is more encompassing than an individual or personal issue. Of course, change must come from within the individual. But when you are seeking to find solutions to global problems, this requires the ability to address problems from various levels, the individual level, the community level, and the global level. Now, for instance, minimizing hatred is like internal disarmament. But internal disarmament must go with external disarmament. The whole world should be demilitarized. That is our ultimate goal. Of course, we cannot achieve this overnight. I think the realistic way is step by step. So on one level, we should be working towards developing inner peace. But at the same time, it's very important to work towards external disarmament and peace as well, making a small contribution in whatever way we can. That's our responsibility.
We've seen how there is a reciprocal relationship between a supple mind and the ability to shift perspective. A supple, flexible mind helps us address our problems from a variety of perspectives, and conversely, deliberately trying to objectively examine our problems from a variety of perspectives can be seen as a kind of flexibility training for the mind. In today's world, the attempt to develop a flexible mode of thinking isn't simply a self-indulgent exercise for idle intellectuals. It can be a matter of survival. Even on an evolutionary scale, the species that were most adaptable were the ones that survived and thrived. Life today is characterized by sudden, unexpected, and sometimes violent change. A supple mind can help us reconcile the external changes going on all around us. It can also help us integrate all of our internal conflicts, inconsistencies, and ambivalence. Without a pliant mind, our outlook becomes brittle and our relationship to the world is characterized by fear. But by adopting a flexible approach to life, we can maintain our composure even under the most restless and turbulent conditions, and nurture the resiliency of the human spirit.
Chapter 11. Finding Meaning in Pain and Suffering.
By realizing the nature of suffering, you will develop a greater resolve to put an end to the causes of suffering.
If shifting perspective is one way to make life's trials and problems more bearable, another is to be able to find meaning in pain and suffering. As Viktor Frankl, a Jewish psychiatrist imprisoned by the Nazis in World War II, once said, "Man is ready and willing to shoulder any suffering, as soon and as long as he can see meaning in it." In discussing how personal suffering can take on meaning, the Dalai Lama illustrates how suffering can be put to practical use within the context of the Buddhist tradition.
In Buddhist practice, one can use one's personal suffering in a formal way to enhance compassion by using it as an opportunity for the practice of Tongling, or giving and receiving, a Mahayana visualization practice in which one mentally visualizes taking on another's pain and suffering, and in turn giving them all of your resources, good health, fortune, and so on. So, in doing this practice, when you undergo illness, pain, or suffering, you can use that as an opportunity by thinking, "May my suffering be a substitute for all the suffering of other sentient beings. By experiencing this, may I be able to save all other sentient beings who may have to undergo similar suffering." In describing this practice, if, for instance, you become ill and practice this technique thinking, "May my illness act as a substitute for others who are suffering from similar illness," and you visualize taking on their suffering and giving them your good health, I am not suggesting that you ignore your own health. However, once you do become ill, practices such as Tongling can make a significant difference in how you respond to the situation. Practicing Tongling meditation may not necessarily succeed in alleviating the real physical pain or lead to a cure in physical terms, but it can definitely protect you from unnecessary additional psychological pain, suffering, and anguish. One can think, "May I, by experiencing this pain and suffering, be able to help other people and save others who may have to go through the same experience?" Then your suffering takes on a new meaning as it is used as the basis for a religious or spiritual practice. And on top of that, in the cases of some individuals practicing this technique, that instead of being sorry and saddened by the experience, the person can see it as a kind of privilege. The person can perceive it as a kind of opportunity and, in fact, be joyful because this particular experience made him or her richer.
Paradoxically, the ability to embrace and understand suffering, to find meaning in it or some practical value in it, becomes part of our pursuit of happiness. The Dalai Lama explains how, from a Buddhist perspective, for instance, our suffering acts as a kind of catalyst.
Within the framework of the Buddhist path, reflecting on suffering has tremendous importance. Because by realizing the nature of suffering, you will develop greater resolve to put an end to the causes of suffering and the unwholesome deeds which lead to suffering. And it will increase your enthusiasm for engaging in the wholesome actions and deeds which lead to happiness and joy.
By reflecting on suffering during the quieter moments in our lives, when things are relatively stable and going well, we may discover a deeper value, meaning, or purpose in our suffering. Sometimes, however, we may be confronted with kinds of suffering that seem to have no purpose, with no redeeming qualities whatsoever. Physical pain and suffering often seems to belong to that category. But upon closer examination, even physical pain clearly has a purpose. In his book, Pain, The Gift Nobody Wants, Dr. Paul Brand, a world-renowned hand surgeon and leprosy specialist, explored the purpose and value of physical pain. Leprosy is a disease that causes loss of pain sensation in the limbs, and without the protection of pain, the leprosy patients lack the system to warn them of tissue damage. It is this that causes the horrible disfigurements. After describing his lifelong work with patients who suffer from lack of pain sensation and seeing the devastating effects, Dr. Brand gradually came to view pain not as the universal enemy, but as a remarkable, elegant, and sophisticated biological system that warns us of damage to our body and thus protects us. He feels that we may not be grateful for the experience of pain, but we can be grateful for the system of pain perception. And beyond that, he feels that not only can our attitude about pain change by understanding its meaning and purpose, but that change in attitude can actually lessen the degree to which we suffer when we are physically injured. Like many other researchers, he sees a difference between physical pain, which is a physiological process, and suffering, which is our mental and emotional response to the pain. We convert pain into suffering in the mind. To lessen the suffering of pain, we need to make a crucial distinction between the pain of the pain and the pain we create by our thoughts about the pain. It is well recognized that fear, anger, guilt, loneliness, and helplessness are all mental and emotional responses that can intensify pain. So, in dealing with pain, we can, of course, work at the lower levels of pain perception using the tools of modern medicine such as medication, but we can also work at the higher levels by modifying our outlook and attitude. In seeking to discover an underlying purpose to our physical pain, Dr. Paul Brand makes one additional fascinating and critical observation. He describes many reports of leprosy patients claiming, "Now, of course I can see my hands and my feet, but somehow they don't feel like part of me. It feels as if they were just tools." Thus, pain not only warns us and protects us, it unifies us. Without pain sensation in our hands and feet, those parts no longer seem to belong to our body, and that is associated with a kind of indifference to injury to them. In the same way that physical pain unifies our sense of having a body, the Dalai Lama reminds us that the general experience of suffering acts as a unifying force that connects us with others. Perhaps that is the ultimate meaning behind our suffering. It is the most basic element we share with others, the factor that unifies us with all living creatures.
Third Meditation, The Practice of Tonglen.
At the end of one of his sessions in Arizona, the Dalai Lama instructed the audience in the visualization practice of Tonglen. As we have heard, it is both an exercise for strengthening compassion and a powerful tool for helping transmute one's personal suffering.
This afternoon, let us meditate on the practice of Tonglen, giving and receiving. This practice is meant to help train the mind to strengthen the force of compassion. This is achieved because Tonglen meditation helps to counteract our selfishness. It increases the power and strength of our mind by enhancing our courage to open ourselves to others' suffering. To begin this exercise, first visualize on one side of you a group of people who are in desperate need of help, those who are in an unfortunate state of suffering, those living under conditions of poverty, hardship, and pain. Visualize this group of people on one side of you clearly in your mind. Then on the other side, visualize yourself as the embodiment of a self-centered person with a customary selfish attitude, indifferent to the well-being and needs of others. And then in between this suffering group of people and this selfish representation of you, see yourself in the middle as a neutral observer. Next, notice which side you are naturally inclined toward. See whether your natural feeling of empathy reaches out to the group of weaker people who are in need, or if it is inclined more towards that single individual, the embodiment of selfishness on the other side. If you look objectively, you can see that the well-being of a group or a large number of individuals is more important than that of one single individual. After that, focus your attention on the needy and desperate people. Direct all of your positive energy toward them. Mentally, give them your successes, your resources, your collection of virtues, and take upon yourself their suffering, their problems, and all their negativities. For example, you can visualize an innocent starving child from Somalia and feel how you would respond naturally towards that sight. In this instance, when you experience a deep feeling of empathy towards the suffering of that individual, it isn't based on considerations like, he's my relative or she's my friend. You don't even know that person. But the fact that the other person is a human being and you yourself are a human being allows your natural capacity for empathy to emerge, enabling you to reach out. So you can visualize something like that and think, this child has no capacity of his or her own to be able to relieve himself or herself from his or her present state of difficulty or hardship. Then mentally take upon yourself all the suffering of poverty, starvation, and the feeling of deprivation, and mentally give your facilities, wealth, and success to this child. So, through practicing this kind of giving and receiving visualization, you can train your mind. When engaging in this practice, it is sometimes helpful to begin by first imagining your own future suffering and, with an attitude of compassion, take your own future suffering upon yourself right now with the wish of freeing yourself from all future suffering. After you gain some practice, you can then expand the process to include taking on the suffering of others. When you do the visualization of taking upon yourself, it is useful to visualize these sufferings, problems, and difficulties in the form of poisonous substances, dangerous weapons, or terrifying animals, things that, normally, the very sight of which makes you shudder. So visualize the suffering in these forms, and then absorb them directly into your heart. The purpose of visualizing these negative and frightening forms being dissolved into our hearts is to destroy our habitual selfish attitudes that reside there. However, for those individuals who may have problems with self-image, self-hatred, or low self-esteem, then it is important to judge for themselves whether this particular practice is appropriate or not. This Tonglin practice can become quite powerful if you combine the giving and receiving with the breath. That is, imagine receiving when inhaling and giving when exhaling. When you do this visualization effectively, it will make you feel some slight discomfort. That is an indication that it is hitting its target, the self-centered, egocentric attitude that we normally have.
Part 4. Overcoming Obstacles. Chapter 12. Bringing About Change.
Our positive states of mind can act as antidotes to our negative tendencies and illusory states of mind.
It is important to remember that the Dalai Lama's emphasis on recognizing the inevitability of suffering and the uses of suffering emerged from a fundamentally optimistic context, the Buddhist belief in the possibility of genuine transformation and change.
Earlier, we mentioned that in seeking happiness, we begin by learning about how negative emotions and behaviors are harmful to us and how positive states of mind are helpful. But in discussing an approach to bringing about positive changes within oneself, learning is only the first step. There are other factors as well: conviction, determination, action, and effort. Next, one transforms determination into action. The strong determination to change enables us to make a sustained effort to implement the actual changes. The final factor of effort is critical. Now, no matter what behavior you are seeking to change, no matter what particular goal or action you are directing your efforts towards, you need to start by developing a strong willingness or wish to do it. You need to generate great enthusiasm. And here, a sense of urgency is a key factor. For example, knowledge about the serious effects of AIDS has definitely created a sense of urgency that has put a check on a lot of people's sexual behavior. I think that often, once we obtain the proper information, that sense of seriousness and commitment will come. So, this sense of urgency can be a vital factor in affecting change. It can give us tremendous energy. For instance, in a political movement, if there is a sense of desperation, there can be a tremendous sense of urgency. So much so that people may even forget they are hungry, and there is no feeling of tiredness or exhaustion in pursuit of their objectives.
I asked the Dalai Lama if there was a particular Buddhist approach to help develop that sense of urgency.
For a Buddhist practitioner to generate a sense of confidence and enthusiasm, we find in the Buddhist texts a discussion of the preciousness of human existence. We talk about how much potential lies within our body, how meaningful it can be, the good purposes it can be used for, the benefits and advantages of having a human form. Then, in order to generate a sense of urgency, to engage in spiritual practices, the practitioner is reminded of one's impermanence, of death. The awareness of impermanence is encouraged so that when it is coupled with your appreciation of the enormous potential of your human existence, it will give you a sense of urgency that I must use every precious moment.
Given the Dalai Lama's view that one must generate a high degree of enthusiasm to effect positive changes in one's life, I asked him about his approach to overcoming apathy. He suggested first ruling out a physical or biological cause that may contribute to a feeling of low energy or laziness. Then he continued,
"To overcome apathy and generate enthusiasm, to overcome one's negative behaviors and states of mind, once again, I think the most effective method, and perhaps the only solution, is to be constantly aware of the destructive effects of the negative behavior. One may need to repeatedly remind oneself of those destructive effects. Now, most people want to make positive changes in their lives, but sometimes we simply become habituated or accustomed to doing things in certain ways. And then we become sort of spoiled, doing only the things that we like to do, that we are used to doing. But we can also use habituation to our advantage. Through constant familiarity, we can definitely establish new behavior patterns. So by making a steady effort, I think we can overcome any form of negative conditioning and make positive changes in our lives. But you still need to realize that genuine change doesn't happen overnight. Deep down. Mental development takes time and a consistent effort.
Because of the slow and gradual nature of change and transformation, I wondered what prevented the Dalai Lama from becoming discouraged or losing hope.
As far as my own spiritual practice goes, if I encounter some obstacles or problems, I find it helpful to stand back and take the long-term view rather than the short-term view. In this regard, I find that thinking about one particular verse gives me courage and helps me sustain my determination. As long as space endures, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too live to dispel the miseries of the world. However, as far as the struggle for the freedom of Tibet is concerned, if I utilize that kind of belief, being prepared to wait as long as space endures for eons and eons and so on, I think that would be foolish. Here, one needs to take more immediate or active involvement. But even in the situation in Tibet, I think that viewing the situation from a wider perspective can definitely help. For instance, if I look at the situation inside Tibet from a narrow perspective, focusing only on that, then the situation appears almost hopeless. However, if I look from a wider perspective, a world perspective, then I see the international situation in which whole communist and totalitarian systems are collapsing, where even in China there's a democracy movement and the spirit of Tibetans remains high. So I don't give up.
There's no doubt that in order to accomplish important goals, we need a strong driving mechanism to sustain us. Looking at the factors that motivate us to action, psychologists have identified three principal types of human motives. Primary motives are drives based on biological needs that must be met for survival, such as food, water, and air. Another category of motives involves our innate need for stimulation and information. The final category, called secondary motives, are those based on learned needs, such as the need for success, status, power, or achievement. These are acquired drives that can be influenced by social forces and shaped by learning. And it is at this level that modern psychological theories meet the Buddhist concept of developing determination and enthusiasm. In Buddhism, however, these acquired drives are not used only in the pursuit of worldly success, but in pursuit of higher goals, kindness, compassion, and spirituality. And develop as one gains a clearer understanding of the factors that lead to true happiness. Once we have built up a certain degree of drive and determination to make the changes necessary to live a happier life, we must then set about implementing these changes in our customary ways of thinking and acting. While science has recently revealed that one's genetic predisposition plays some role in an individual's characteristic way of responding to the world, most social scientists and psychologists feel that a large measure of the way we behave, think, and feel is determined by learning and conditioning, which comes about as a result of our upbringing and the various social and cultural forces around us. And since it is believed that behaviors are largely established by conditioning and reinforced and amplified by habituation, this opens up the possibility, as the Dalai Lama contends, of extinguishing harmful or negative conditioning and replacing it with helpful, life-enhancing conditioning. In eliminating one's negative emotions and states of mind, however, one question arises. Since these negative emotions seem to be a natural or integral part of our psychological makeup, is it really reasonable or practical to try to eradicate them?
Yes. Some people suggest that anger, hatred, and other negative emotions are a natural part of our mind, and there is no way to really change these mental states. But that is wrong. Now, for example, all of us are born in an ignorant state. In this sense, ignorance is also quite natural. But as we grow through education and learning, we can acquire knowledge and dispel ignorance. And in that same way, through proper training, we can gradually reduce our negative emotions and increase positive states of mind such as love, compassion, and forgiveness. When speaking of these negative states of mind, I am referring to what are called yang meng in Tibetan, or klesha in Sanskrit. This term literally means that which afflicts from within. It is often translated as delusions. It's easy to recognize the afflictive nature of these delusions simply because they have this tendency to destroy our calmness and presence of mind. But it's much more difficult to find out whether or not we can overcome them. That is a question that directly relates to the whole idea of whether or not it is possible to attain the full realization of our spiritual potential. That is a very serious and difficult situation. Now, in Buddhist thought, we have three principal premises on which we believe that can happen. The first premise is that all deluded states of mind, all afflictive emotions and thoughts, are essentially distorted in that they are rooted in misperceiving the actual reality of the situation. No matter how powerful, deep down these negative emotions have no valid foundation. They are based on ignorance. On the other hand, positive emotions or states of mind, such as love, compassion, insight, have a solid basis. When the mind is experiencing these positive states, there is no distortion. In addition, these positive factors are grounded in reality. They can be verified by our own experience. There is a kind of grounding and rootedness in reason and understanding, and this is not the case with afflictive emotions like anger and hatred. On top of that, all these positive states of mind have the quality that you can enhance them and increase them to a limitless degree if you regularly practice them through training and constant familiarity. The second premise on which we base the claim that our negative emotions can be rooted out and eliminated is based on the fact that our positive states of mind can act as antidotes to our negative tendencies and illusory states of mind. And as you enhance the capacity of these antidotal factors, the greater their force, the more you will be able to reduce the force of the mental and emotional afflictions. Within Buddhist practice, the cultivation of certain specific positive mental qualities, such as patience, tolerance, kindness, and so on, can act as specific antidotes to negative states of mind, such as anger, hatred, and attachment. But since these positive antidotes seek to eliminate only certain specific emotions, in some sense they can be seen as only partial measures. These afflictive emotions, such as attachment and hatred, are ultimately rooted in ignorance, misconception of the true nature of reality. Therefore, in order to fully overcome all of these negative tendencies, one must apply the antidote to ignorance, the wisdom factor. The wisdom factor involves generating insight into the true nature of reality. So we not only have specific antidotes for specific negative emotions, for example, patience and tolerance act as specific antidotes to anger and hatred, but we also have a general antidote, insight, into the true nature of reality that acts as an antidote to all negative states of mind. It is similar to getting rid of a poisonous plant. You can eliminate the harmful effects by cutting off the specific branches or leaves, or you can eliminate the entire plant by